Good evening. I'm delighted to see so many people here tonight. You're in for a treat. I see many of you have books in hand. Tonight we have Jacqueline Carey coming to read for us. She's the author of the Cushield Trilogy. She was a native of Highland Park, Illinois, and currently resides in Michigan over on the western side of the state. She's also written some nonfiction, such as Angels, Celestial Spirits, and Art and Legend. And without my belaboring any more points, we're delighted to have you here tonight, Jacqueline. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Leslie, and thanks to all of you for coming. I hear this is a good turnout. I hope you all don't regret it, because I usually prepare really well for events like this, but I didn't. And it's not like I even have a really good excuse for it. It's the good old standbys: pessimism, indecision, and procrastination. So every time I thought about preparing this week, I thought, Friday night, college campus, there's not going to be anyone there. And what am I going to read anyway? I could play it safe, go with something from Dart or some portion of the trilogy, dig up an old short story, maybe, that would have some cohesion, one of those things I published on the web long ago and wish I hadn't. Or, you know, I could go with something from the new book. If I actually get some fans there, they might be kind of excited about that. And, oh, who am I kidding? I'm going to end up reading to the custodial staff. It's going to be one of those nights. All of which leads to procrastination. I'll be honest. I spent the last week catching up on all the seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that I missed over the past few years. Proud to say I've made it through season 3. But since this pretty much follows my MO for studying in college, I thought maybe you guys would cut me some slack. And this is important stuff. I was way behind on the Buffy curve. I didn't watch it for years because my satellite service didn't carry whatever channel it was on, and then it moved to another channel, which they also didn't carry. And that was all probably somewhat my fault, because years before I got really mad at my satellite service for doing one of those forcible upgrades where they said, for a mere $10 extra a month, you now have a bazillion new shopping, sports, and family programming channels to choose from. Not to mention all those music channels that nobody ever listens to, except for my one crazy friend Marty, who used to be really into heavy metal, and now all she does is put on that, like, smooth jazz channel. I don't know what that's all about. But I got mad, and I cut back on my basic cable. It said, just take me down to the absolute bare bones, which still had plenty of shopping and sports and family programming, but no free music channels. And no Buffy. But now there are DVDs, so I've been catching up. You'll all be very pleased to know. The thing is, for years, people were constantly trying to talk to me about this show, because everyone assumed that I was a fan of it. It's got smart writing and a kick-ass heroine. I'm a smart writer with a heroine, who is not exactly kick-ass, but she has her own unique talents. I'm guessing people here familiar with the books, somewhat, seeing some nods. For people who aren't, they're really hard. I should bring out the one I brought. We have a visual aid here. Thonk. They're tough books to describe. I took part in a panel discussion earlier this year called Building the Multi-Layered Plot, and one of the authors participating, Melissa Scott, said, well, let's try and establish what this is before we go about trying to explain how to do it. And she cited Cushiel's Dart, which she had told me that she'd very much enjoyed, and she said, I recommended it to a friend who said, well, what's it about? She said, so I started to explain. Half an hour later, I'm still talking. My best effort at a short version. Cushiel's legacy, overall, is a trilogy of historical fantasy novels set in Terre d'Ange, where the people are descended from wandering angels and Blessed Elua, a deity born of the mingled blood of Yeshua ben Yosef, or Jesus Christ, and the tears of Mary Magdalene. They are narrated by Phaedra Nodelene, who is sold into indentured servitude as a child and raised to become a courtesan and spy, and is very, very good at what she does in her own unique way, which is how she happens to save her nation from conquest and usurpation. And that's just the first two books. She acquires a number of friends, lovers, and enemies along the way, some of which are indistinguishable from one another. These include her perfect companion, Jocelyn Barai, the Castellan warrior priest. I had a number of people tell me before the release of Avatar that if he does not make it through to the end of the trilogy, I would be well advised to reread Stephen King's Misery and think about it. Phaedra also has her arch nemesis in the person of Melisande Shahrazai, who is very beautiful and very brilliant, and who Phaedra both despises and desires, and whom my mother has begged me on numerous occasions to please, please kill off. That's kind of the superficial description, which is not terribly satisfying, but since many of you have read them, I'm not going to sit here and talk for half an hour trying to get at it. I actually came across one that I really liked that may resonate with other readers and writers and lovers of books. Authors are often asked who they like to read, and I read across a really broad spectrum. Over the past couple of years, I rediscovered an author I could not stand as a teenager, and discovered even in my 20s I was still resisting. John Steinbeck. It's a funny thing. Reading Steinbeck as an adult is a really different experience. I used to see his writing as just bleak and depressing. When I revisited it, which my book club made me do, I really saw in his work the compassion for and love of humanity that permeates it, which is not to say, for obvious reasons, that my work is anything like Steinbeck's. His best-known books are gritty dramas playing out against the tapestry of American history, and I'm writing a trilogy set in an alternate medieval Provence about the epic adventures of a cheerfully masochistic heroine with a knack for diplomacy and espionage. His works are on the curricula of English classes across the nation, and mine are read beneath the desks of English classes across the nation. But he wrote a foreword to East of Eden, which I really loved, and it struck a chord with me. A friend came upon him carving a little figure out of wood and said, "Why don't you make something for me?" And Steinbeck said, "What do you want?" "A box." "What for?" "Not to put things in." So he wrote East of Eden. And of it he wrote, "Well, here's your box. Nearly everything I have is in it, and it is not full. Pain and excitement are in it, and feeling good or bad, and evil thoughts and good thoughts, the pleasure of design and some despair, and the indescribable joy of creation. And on top of all of these are all the gratitude and love I have for you. And still, the box is not full." And that's how I feel about the Kushiel's Legacy trilogy, and in some ways, especially the culminating volume, Avatar. They're filled with high intrigue and epic adventure, suspense, betrayal, spiritual heights, dark passions, true romance, and dastardly villainy. You know, all those great things that I love as a reader. And they can be read on that level alone. But there are other elements in them, too. They deal with the devastating effects of war and violence, which has unfortunately been a timely topic, as I've both written and come out with the last volume. But ultimately, they celebrate the transcendence of the human spirit and the awesome and terrible power of love. And that was what I had to put in the box I built. And still, it is not full. But I think my editor would have killed me if I'd tried to cram anything else in it. So I thought about doing a reading from Avatar tonight, but it's really hard with the last volume of a trilogy to pick a passage that is dynamic in any way, that doesn't require a huge amount of setup, because you've got 1,400 pages of backstory, almost 2,000 if you're talking paperback, and, you know, give away major plot spoilers to anyone who hasn't read it, thinks they might. I did a West Coast tour this spring, and about halfway through, I started out doing readings
and then questions and answers. And about the halfway point, I just ditched the readings and went straight into questions and answers. And we ended up having really lively, engaging conversations that I think were more interesting for both the audience and for me. So I'm going to kind of throw this out. I wasn't sure what I would find here tonight, whether it would be fans or idly curious or custodial staff patiently waiting for me to shut up and go home. So I thought I'd take a sort of wait-and-see approach and kind of poll people. I can do DART is what I brought, which I am happy to do a reading from the beginning. So for anyone who's not familiar and may be interested, they get a sense of the language. If I see eager and excited looks on faces, I can also. I do have an excerpt from what will be my next book, which is not scheduled for publication until November 2004. So that would be a little bit of a teaser. Okay, I got a couple of nods. We can throw it open to questions and answers. I have more material here. I can tell stories of the highlights and lowlights of what I've learned since I became a published author in the last couple of years. Anyone? Anyone? Yes?
I have a question. If your books were made into movies, who would you see playing?
Oh. Okay, let's save that for when we definitely are going to do questions and answers. And then we'll start taking polls. But, okay, since I got a couple of people perk up a little, I think I'm going to go with option B, plan B. And I have to admit, this is not something I've rehearsed. Usually I do like to do a few run-throughs and familiarize myself so I can deliver material without everybody falling asleep, because contrary to what they'd have you believe on NPR, authors are not exactly born entertainers. But what I'm going to read then is a portion of the first chapter of my next novel, which I just delivered the final draft of it to Tor. And as I said, it's scheduled for publication a year from now, November 2004. It was originally titled Elegy for Darkness, but that has recently been changed to Godslayer. All my titles get changed. It's one of those things, almost all of them. It's unrelated, and it's quite different from the Kushiel books. It's a standalone. It's a straightforward good versus evil epic fantasy in the vein of Tolkien, most deliberately so, with one twist, which is that it's told from the losing side's perspective. And there's a long prologue that establishes the mythos of the setting, but it's really kind of prologue-y. So I decided I would, if I went with this, I would just kind of launch into something from chapter one. And it's the kind of thing where I think if you're familiar with the genre, you'll sort of know the drill. Good, evil, world divided, magic gems, enchanted weapon, cranky wizard, awfully taciturn, prophecy, big war brewing. So I'm taking very deliberately a lot of standard tropes and familiar tropes and which emerge over the course of it, but of course putting my own spin by looking at it from the other side. And unfortunately for my anti-heroes, of whom I am very fond, y'all know how the story ends. This is how it starts. Tanaros walked down the hallway, black marble echoing beneath his boot heels. It was like an unlit mirror, that floor, polished to a high gleam. The archways were vast, not built to a human scale. All along the walls, the marrow fire burned, delicate veins of blue-white against all that shining blackness. In it, his reflection was blurred and distorted. There was Tanaros, there, and there, and there. A pale brow, furrowed, a lock of dark hair falling, so. Capable hands. And a stern mouth, its soft words of love long since betrayed. It had been a long time, a very long time, since Tanaros had thought of such matters. Of the sum total, the pieced together fragments of his being made. Nor did he think of them now, for his lord's summons burned like a beacon in his mind. And beneath his attire, beneath the enameled armor that sheltered him, His branding burned like marrow fire on his flesh, white hot and cold as ice, throbbing as his heart beat and piercing. So it was for the three. "Guardsman," he said in greeting. "General Tenaros, sir." The Haven Guard Fjolltroll on duty grinned, showing his eye tusks. His weapons hung about him like boulders on the verge of avalanche. He hoisted one, a sharp-pointed mace, in salute as he stood aside. Beyond him, the entrance to the tower stair yawned like an open mouth. "His lordship awaits you in the observatory." "Krognar," Tenaros said, remembering his name. "Thank you." "My pleasure, Lord General." The Fjolltroll saluted again. It was a long way to the observatory, to the very top of the utmost tower of Darkhaven. Tenaros climbed it step by step, feeling his heartbeat increasing as he labored. A mortal heart, circumscribed by the silvered scar of his branding. When all was said and done, he was a man, nothing more. It was his lordship who had made him one of the three, and deathless. He heard his breath labor, in and out. Mortal lungs, circulating blood. How long had they been at that task? It had been 1,000 years and more since Tenaros had answered his lord's first summons, his hands red with the lifeblood of one he had once loved, his heart filled with rage and anguish. It felt longer. He wondered, briefly, how Vorax made the long climb. Darkness, spiraling on darkness, broad steps wrought by the Fjolltroll, made to endure their broad, horny feet. Tenaros reached out, touching the spiraling wall of the tower, fingers trailing. It should have burned, the marrow fire. It did burn, but faintly. Here the veins branched and branched again, growing ever thinner and fainter as the tower thrust upward into the darkness. It was always dark, here. Tenaros paused in the entrance to the observatory, letting his eyes adjust. Dark. It was always dark. Even the windows opened onto darkness and the night sky. There, the stars that never shone in cloud-blotted daylight. "My lord," he bowed, crisp and correct, as he had bowed for centuries on end. "Tenaros." The voice rumbled, deep as mountains. It soothed, easing his joints, loosening the stiffness of centuries, of honor betrayed and never forgotten. It always had. In the darkness, the shaper was silhouetted in the windows of night, vast shoulders occluding the stars. A pair of eyes glinted like crimson embers. "You have come." Tenaros took a breath, feeling his lungs loosen. "Always, my lord Satoris." "It is well." In a carven chair in the corner sat Vorax, his thick limbs akimbo, fanning himself and breathing hard. Long ago he had been a lord of the race of men, dwelling in the cool clime of Statia, far to the north. Gluttony, greed, and a ruthless pragmatism had moved him to answer the Shaper's summons, becoming one of the immortal three. He grinned at Tenaros from where he sprawled, his beard fanning over his massive chest. "Grave doings, cousin, is it not so?" "If you say so, cousin." Tenaros did not sit in his lord's presence. Long ago, he had stood vigilant in the presence of his king as he stood now in the presence of one far greater. Loyalties changed. Protocol did not. He inclined his head in deference. "We await the dream spinner, my lord?" "Yes." His lord turned to the westernmost window, gazing out at the night. "Tell me, Tenaros, what do you see thence?" He made his way to his lord's side. It was like standing beside a stoked forge, the might of the shaper beating against his skin in waves. In the air, a scent, coppery and sweet, like fresh spilled blood, only stronger. "Where, my lord?" "There." Satoris pointed to the west, the line of his arm unerring. It could not be otherwise, of course, for westward lay Torath and the Summa, the eye and the brow of Uru-Alat, and Lord Satoris was a shaper. Though his brethren had cast him out, though their allies reviled him and called him Sunderer, Banereaker, and Prince of Lies, he was a shaper. Day or night, above the earth or below it, he knew where the Summa lay, beyond the sundering sea. Tenaros gripped the edge of the casement and looked west into the night. The low mountains surrounding Darkhaven rose in ridges, silvered by a waning moon. Far, far beyond, he could see the faintest shimmer of surging darkness on the distant horizon where the sea began. Below, it was quiet, only an occasional clatter to be heard in the barracks of the Fjolltroll, a voice raised to break the silence. Above, there was the night sky, thin clouds scudding, scattered with pinpricks of stars and the waning moon. As it was since time had begun, since Arahila the Fair had shaped them into being that the children of men might not fear the darkness. No, There, there, low on the horizon, a star, a red star. It was faint, but it was there. Its light throbbed, faint and fickle, red. Leather and steel creaked as Vorax levered his bulk to his feet, his breathing audible in the tower chamber, louder as he saw the star and sucked his breath between his teeth with a hiss. Red star, he said. That wasn't there before. Tenaros, who had not known fear for many years, knew it now. He let go the edge of the casement and flexed his hands, tasting fear and wishing for his black sword. What is it, my lord? The shaper watched the red star flicker low in the distance. A warning. Of what, my lord? The taste of fear in his mouth. From whom? My elder sister. The voice was as soft as a shaper's could be, touched with ages of sorrow. Oh, Arahila. Tenaros closed his eyes. How can that be, my lord? With the Summa shattered and Ur-Ulath sundered, how can it be that Arahila could shape such a thing? Durgael, said Vorax. Durgael's Sumanye. A chip of the Summa, long since shattered, a chip shaped by Haumane Firstborn, chief of shapers, into a gem, one of three. It had been lost even before Tenaros was born, when Haumane sent his three wise counselors to make war upon his lordship. The counselor Durgael, who had borne the arrow of fire, had known defeat and flung himself into the sea rather than allow the gem or the weapon to fall into enemy hands. For over 1,000 years, both had been lost. Yes, said Satoris, watching. Durgael's Sumanye. Tenaros' mouth had gone dry. What does it mean, my lord? Satoris Thirdborn watched the red star, and the faint light of the waning moon silvered his dark visage. Calm, so calm. Unmoving, he stood and watched, while ichor seeped like blood from the unhealing wound he bore, laying a glistening trail down the inside of his thigh, never ceasing. War, he said. It means war. Footsteps sounded on the tower stair, quick and light, announcing Ushaheen's arrival. The half-breed entered the chamber, bowing. My lord Satoris. Dream spinner, the shaper acknowledged him. You have news? In the dim light, there was beauty in the ruined face, the mismatched features. The half-breed's smile was like the edge of a knife, deadly and bitter. I have passed across the plains of Curanon like the wind, my lord, and walked in the dreams of men while they slept. I have news. Sarilind of the Elalan, granddaughter of Altarion, has agreed to wed Ericus Altoris of the Children of Men. When a daughter of Altarion weds a son of Altoris, it was one of the conditions of Haumane's prophecy, those deeds by which the Lord of Thought vowed Satoris would be overthrown and defeated, and Ur-Ulath reclaimed by the six shapers who remained. Vorax cursed with Astacian's fluency. Tenaros was silent, remembering. Ericus Altoris. There had been another of that house, once. There had been many others, and Altoris Farseer first among them, in the first age of the sundered world. For Tenaros, born in the years of dwindling glory, there was only one. Roscus Altoris, whom he had called king, and my lord. Roscus, dearer to him than any brother. Red gold hair, a ready smile, a strong hand extended to clasp in friendship, or in love, as his hand had clasped that of Tenaros' wife. Claiming her, possessing her, leading her to his bed, where he got her with child. Tenaros trembled with hatred. Steady, cousin. Borax's hand was heavy on his shoulder, and there was sympathy in the Stachian's voice. They knew each other well, the three, after so long. This concerns us all. Ushaheen Dreamspinner said nothing, but his eyes gleamed in the dark chamber. Near black, the one, its pupil fixed and wide, the other waxed and waned like the moon, set in a pale, crazed iris. So it had been since the day he was beaten and left for dead, and men said it was madness to meet his eyes. What the Elalan thought, no one knew. My lord Satoris, Tenaros found his voice, what would you have of us? Readiness. Calm, still calm, though it seemed the ichor bled faster from his wound, the broad trail glistening wider. Tenaros, command of the armies is yours. Those who are on leave must be recalled, and each squadron a full complement. There must be new recruits. Vorax, see to our lines of supply and those allies who might be bribed or bought. Ushaheen, the shaper smiled. Do as you do. They bowed, each of the three, pressing clenched fists to their hearts. "We will not fail you, my lord," Tenaros said for them all. "My brave lieutenants," Satoris' words hung in the air, gentle. "My brother Halmany seeks my life to end the long quarrel between us. This you know. But all the weapons and all the prophecies in the sundered world avail him not, so long as the dagger godslayer remains safe in our charge, and where it lies, no hand but mine may touch it. This I promise you, for so long as the Marrow Fire burns, I shall reign in Darkhaven, and you three with me. It is the pact of your branding, and I shall not fail it. Now go, and see that we are in readiness." They went. On the horizon, the red star of war flickered. Say two. Like I said, it's definitely different in tone. But it was something where, after several years and thousands of pages in Teardange, I needed to do something that was a change. And it was also the kind of idea that's just sort of sitting out there like a giant lobbed baseball that somebody's got to hit sooner or later. So, so that's all I had planned. I thought I can continue talking, or we can open this up because it looks like kind of a good crowd. Do we want to kick off the playing the casting game, which you had asked earlier? People do ask that quite frequently. Who would you cast in the movie? And I am the worst person in the world to answer it because I just don't have any objectivity. Can't do it. Heath Ledger seems to be a leading favorite for Jocelyn at this point. I hear from other people. I also understand Jocelyn has been spotted in Canada. this is one of my favorite reader mail I've gotten in the last year or so from two young enough that it makes me a little uneasy to think about them reading the work, teenagers and 14-year-old Canadians, sophisticated young women, had apparently gone to a Hallmark store somewhere near Quebec City, I think. And they totally saw Jocelyn there, like he had the wheat blonde hair and the summer blue eyes and everything. And when he spoke, his voice was like a purling stream, just the way they always imagined it. I'm like, purling stream? You know, he's actually kind of laconic. There's not a lot of purling and burbling going on there, but... And then it went on, because they were bored in lunch, so one of them wrote, "Jocelyn lives" on her friend's hand. And then the English teacher saw it and asked what that meant, and who was this Jocelyn? And she had to totally make up this story. Why? I don't know. About how she was at the YMCA for a yoga class, and he was this really cute 16-year-old guy in her yoga class, because you know if Jocelyn were alive today, he'd totally take yoga. And I actually got this version from both the friends separately. But yeah, that's as much consensus as I've seen emerge. Some lobbying for Angelina Jolie as Melisande as well. I think actually she'd probably be pretty good. Anyone have other suggestions or another question?
Question.
Yeah.
What inspired you to write the trilogy?
That's funny, I was just saying. Author's least favorite question. Because it's really impossible to answer. There are so many sources. Some of it was a trip to Provence that I took. Some of it came from misremembering something I read in the Dictionary of Angels. Some of it, I have absolutely no idea where it came from. There are some sources of deliberate inspiration. I looked at more historical fiction than fantasy, actually. Books I'd love, like I was a big fan of Mary Renault and her novels of ancient Greece. Robert Graves' I, Claudius books. But how it all comes together is really a mystery. It's a form of alchemy that couldn't begin to explain.
Do you think there's any chance that the title Godslayer will be changed? I'm good friends with the Walden's fantasy buyer, Kurt Hassler, and I know that he's going to talk to his core representative saying that Godslayer is a very common term amongst fantasy titles and that Elegy for Darkness is much more unique.
Yeah, I don't know. I pointed it out because there was, I can't remember the name, Mickey Zucker, Reinhardt, something, some combination, has a book that came out 10, 15 years ago called Godslayer. I like Elegy for Darkness a lot better, too. Publishers don't always tell you everything. And the reason they gave me is, marketing doesn't think it's punchy enough. But I happened to notice somewhere that Elizabeth Hayden, who is another tour author and also in their Women in Fantasy program, had a book in the queue, I think, ahead of mine, oddly enough, titled Elegy for a Lost Star. And she's kind of working on a theme, too, so that may be a factor. I don't know. I don't know if anybody's got some alternate titles to pitch out here. We may end up having to go back to the drawing board. I really like Elegy for Darkness because I think it's perfectly apt and a little more subtle and sophisticated, but who knows?
You mentioned other titles that have been changed. What were the original titles? Are you referring to the Kushiel series?
Yeah, Kushiel's Dart we all agreed on. But I had titled the second volume Nama's Servant, and the third would have been Elua's Child, which, again, I actually like better. But in this case, I think they wanted to, it was a branding issue, and it was probably very much the right decision from a marketing standpoint. But, you know, still harbor a little fondness in my heart.
Did you delve into any mythology because you've got Celtic, Pictish, French, German, Scandinavian, hints of Slavic?
Yeah, I've always been a huge mythology buff. Like I said, I think it all does go back to Mary Renault. That was the first grown-up book I ever read was The Persian Boy. Which is about the latter half of the life of Alexander the Great. And I was 10 years old, I was at camp, and we had to do this forced nap time after lunch thing, which I really hated. And I'd gone through all my little Nancy Drew books or whatever I'd brought, and the counselor had this book on her shelf, and I thought, well, that looks quite interesting. Excuse me. only without the burp. And I asked her if I could read it. She said, ooh, I think it's a little grown up for you. I was all, please. I'm so bored. I'm not a good napper. So she finally agreed. And I loved the book, in part because of the mythology that permeates it and the way it's presented not as, hey, here's this funky pantheon of exotic deities, but as a living faith of various characters, which is something you don't often find in fantasy. So from that point onward, despite the fact there were certain things I didn't fully understand, like when he was made into a eunuch, I was a little sketchy on what that meant. Later I kind of went, oh my god. I became a big myth buff and have always, just in my own dilettante way, studied mythology. So there's a lot. Sometimes I know exactly what I'm looking for, and I'm like, okay, going for a prose Edda today. I think there's something in there. Other times it's just elements that intrigue me that I appropriate and kind of weave into the fabric. But almost all of the mythology throughout the books is appropriated from an existing religion or mythos, living or dead, or even some in a sort of half-life. Even in the third, in the Darshanga sequence, which is some of the hardest stuff I've ever had to write, that's if Zoroastrianism had an evil dark side, that would be it. So. Mm-hmm.
If you could pronounce some of your characters' names, so we
can. Well, I don't like to lay down a pronunciation because I really prefer to have readers settle on what they're most comfortable with, unless they're completely flailing. Generally, you can anglicize them a lot, a little, or not at all, and I tend to fall on the side of anglicizing somewhat, just because I'm an English speaker and it's easier for me. So I'll say Jocelyn and not Jocelyn, or Isandra the Queen and not Isolde. So it does depend on just how into the either French or Celtic. God help me. I was in Ireland last month for a trip, which was beautiful and spectacular. And that is a language, all as far as I know, of the Celtic languages that are just absolutely unfathomable. You know, they put these consonants together. It's like, was it B and D is pronounced like a Y if it's before a fat vowel, but a G if it's before a skinny vowel. I'm like, what are you doing with these letters? So, you know, if there's some you're really stuck on, I'll try and help you out. But otherwise, I tend to feel that whatever people hear in their head that sounds right to them is what they ought to go with. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. And in fact, it's more than true. There's been discussion and deal making going on, and was all finalized. I wasn't able to update the website, but that is going to be the next project. So I'm really excited about it. I think it's going to be just really fascinating to do something with the protagonist who's so much the psychological flip side, and he's already built in buckets and buckets of angst. Just so yeah, I'll be making an official announcement, but unofficially, it's where we're going. Any other questions or? Mm-hmm.
I noticed on your website that Kushiel came from that Dictionary of Angels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, everyone but Eloa, okay. Who is the entry that I misremembered and thought I had seen something in there that I hadn't. This is years ago. That was one of those things that just sparked my imagination, and I kind of cogitated on for, 3 years maybe. But yeah, all the others are drawn directly. They're all more or less obscure. None of them are big name angels, as it were. I think Kushiel's just referenced really briefly in some. Gosh, I can't even remember. It's not a canonical text, but yeah, they all have. When I was doing research for the nonfiction book on angels, that was a commission I got to do something work for hire, which is, in author world, an evil, evil thing that means you get a flat fee and no royalties ever. But at that point, I hadn't had a break yet, so I'm like, great, I got this idea, and I think I got some research going on here. So that gave me an opportunity to read a lot of the Apocrypha and other pseudepigraphal text, and then some great, like Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews has a lot of folklore compiled that I've drawn on for various elements. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I learned from your trilogy that you have a very wicked sense of humor. Does that get you in trouble in real life?
Not terribly bad trouble. The first incident that popped into mind, a good friend of mine was in the Air Force for some years, and I went to visit him. My girlfriend and I and another friend of ours spent the entire summer on the island of Crete, where he was stationed. Because as soon as he was stationed there, he's like, come for the summer! It'll be great! Air Force is a little lighter on seriousness than some of the other branches. They make jokes about, man, you didn't get to bring your golf clubs to basic training? Bummer. which is not to disparage them, just that they're a little more casual about some things. And we arrived and there was this big hail and farewell party for incoming and outgoing people, which we ended up going to because it was at a bar owned by Scots on the beach in Crete. I don't know why. But as we got there, we were introduced to a couple of my friend Phil's friends, and this one friend, you know, was like, nice to meet you. And, you know, gave a little knowing look and then bent over Phil and massaged his shoulders and whispered in his ear. And I just said, no, you know what? He's not getting laid tonight. We're old friends. And the guy looked at me in shock and said, I didn't say that. I wasn't thinking that. What on earth would mean? He was very defensive. And I said, look, you know, you're leaning over, you're rubbing his shoulders like that, you're whispering in his ear. It's one or the other. And he just continued to deny it and got infuriated and was, you know, doing that in my face thing. And I looked at him and out of my mouth came, easy, Lady Macbeth. I saw him just kind of get a grip on himself and turn and walk away. And Phil leaned forward and said, yeah, he asked me if I was going to get laid tonight. But usually I'm not quite that spontaneous. I sit in front of my computer and think of clever things. And then I put them in somebody else's mouth to say. I ran a contest, actually. I can't even remember what it was for. Maybe it was just a, you know, hey, I'll give you a shout out if you guess for what I thought was the funniest line of Kushiel's Chosen. And I did have a reader who didn't know me at all, must have had the same sense of humor, guess. But it was one of those things when, you know, you've got a heroine who is so very over the top, and your characters need to take themselves seriously, but it's got to be clear sometimes that not everyone takes every little last thing as seriously as they do. And so it was after this great climactic battle and reunion and prevention of assassination in the temple, and Phaedra having, you know, basically saved the world, goes over and immediately goes to kneel in front of the queen, who looks down at her and says, oh, Phaedra, get up. Anyone else? Did you have something that...
Yeah, I was raising his hand, so...
Well, I just thought we'd kind of mix it, you know. I'm alternating. Oh. Very smooth.
Thank you. I'm sure you get asked all the time what your favorite character is. Do you have, like, one of the little minor characters that you just adore and would like to do more with, but they're a minor character, so you don't?
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard, especially when there are some that are just really walk-ons. And I think probably my favorite of all of those is Ras Lajasu in Avatar, who just, he's the Jibian prince, who just cracked me up. I don't know why. I could see him so clearly, I think. And he just had his little, Mooney, help me, I'm beleaguered by beautiful women. I just really enjoyed him. But yeah, there are others. Grania of the Dalriada, she was a fun character. With characters, I feel books that I really love, you feel with almost every character that crosses your path as though the author could have told their story too. They just chose not to because you can only write one at one time, but they're invested with as much life and depth. And so I try to write that way because it's what I like to read. But I must admit, of characters other than Phaedra to write, Melisande is a lot of fun to write. And actually, so is Jocelyn. Or Dog Boy, as I sometimes call him. Ever since that time in the kennels, I have just put him through nothing but hell, the poor guy. You had a question as well.
I've got a very personal question to ask tonight. I have to flog myself. I can't resist asking this.
Well, you can ask it. I don't
do
promise
you have
to answer
any tattoos?
It. Oh. I have found, ever since Dart hit the shelves, people, especially summer, you know, tank top, will be like, so nice to meet you. No, I don't. I will willingly answer that. I did say to myself as I was writing Kushiel's Dart, and it came after I'd probably been a good 10 years plugging away at, you know, wanting to be a novelist. I knew, you know, without breaking through, that this was by far and away the best thing I had ever written. For various reasons, I think my work really took a quantum leap. I took risks, creative risks, risks that were just frightening in terms of dealing with material that was so potentially controversial and provocative, and could I pull it off with a measure of grace and without being exploitative? And, you know, about halfway through, I thought, I kind of think it's working, and I know I cannot write anything better than this. You know, if it's not this, it's not anything. And if this thing sells, I am getting the tattoo. I'm doing it. I'm doing it. And it did. I said, I'm not doing it. But it was largely because at that point, I just felt there was a danger of over-identification. You know, you have enough people saying, so how much of you is in your characters? Or in my case, so how much of you is in your characters? And you can either give the standard, well, there's a little piece of the author in all of the characters. Of course, you know, it's the little, the breath, the spirit that brings them to life. Or you can say, just enough. So I think going with the full spinal mark would probably have sent a message I really didn't intend to. And I have no others, so someday maybe. But at this point now, it's just become this big issue, and I have people sending me photos, which I've got a little tattoo gallery on the website. And I think it's really cool. People are doing this for a lot of different reasons. Some of them just because they like the design and think, hey, that's cool, I was thinking of getting something. And others for more deeply personal reasons, and some of them have shared them with me. And somebody just recently was a graduation present from a friend, the money to do this, and she said it represented freedom to her, the completion of her mark. And there have been a lot of other reasons. But I feel like now I've got to find something that's a little more distant. So you know what I did? I pierced my belly instead. That seemed to satisfy whatever need I had.
Mm-hmm. Does it surprise you the way people have come to identify and accept and what your character is? Things like getting the tattoos and things like that.
The extent of it has. I kind of figured, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, somebody's going to do it. And I saw the first one in spring of 2002, and signing in Madison, a couple of women came up to the table, and one of them said, show her, show her. And she pulled down the back of her shirt. But, yeah, it surprises me in a really happy and delighted way, because I did, in dealing with sensitive material, want to be so careful with it and address issues that had resonance in an unexpected way. And one of my favorite comments, I lost one of my best beloved readers a little over a year ago, my great aunt Harriet, who was the one person in my family who always believed that I would make it. And she had read a lot of the work that I'd written that did not find publication and never doubted. And then I started working on Dart, and I didn't want to let her read it. And then it sold, and I still didn't want to let her read it. And then I got an advance review copy, and I'm like, I'm going to have to deal with this sooner or later. And she lived in Hawaii, so I sent it to her. I was like, oh, God. And she called me after she'd read it. I remember she left a message on my answering machine. I was out. And she just had this quaver in her voice. She's like, it was just Jacqueline. It was marvelous. It's a marvelous book. I hope people realize this is more than just a sex book. I think she was 87 at the time. God bless her. So, yeah, I'm surprised, but in a really good way, that so many people have indeed realized that and responded to it.
You talk about the work that you wrote before, the things that didn't get published. Now that you have this opening, do you feel more able to write things that you were afraid to write before because you didn't have this in, or you weren't published or weren't as successful?
I don't think I was aware that I was holding back before, exactly. I've heard somebody said once, every writer's got at least one book they've got to get out of their system. That's something they really shouldn't write, but they're compelled to write, and then you can go on and write your own stuff. And for me, I had like a couple of them. I had a coming-of-age thing. I had a Mists of Avalon knockoff kind of thing. I had a psychics thing that I'm actually still kind of fond of, but it really was, I learned a lot about writing in the process, but I was not writing work that was really original. It was either obviously derivative or just not that inspired. And I also have a really Baroque natural literary voice, which, of course, you would hear in any writing program, especially during the 80s and early 90s when I was, really in my struggling years. Bad, bad, bad. No, we want spare, pared-down prose. That's what everybody wants. So I taught myself to write that way and kind of muzzled my own natural literary voice, which, again, in Dart, that was the point where I'm like, all right, you know what? Baroque it is. So it was actually kind of scary in a way to do something, elegy, godslayer, whatever it ends up being called, is a little less poetic in prose. There are passages that aren't, but, and that was something that was a scarily ambitious thing to take on that I guess I did give myself permission to. It was very odd, too, to go to multiple third-person points of view after being so completely immersed in one first-person point of view for so long. But it was good to do.
Mm-hmm. What was the description summary you used to pitch Kushiel's Dart? Because people, I push it towards all of my friends, and I've convinced a couple of them to read it, and they've since plowed through the series. And I'm always like, well, and I sort of describe it a little bit, and it's like, you really just have to read it for yourself. Because you can try and describe it, but it just doesn't, it never seems to do it justice.
You know, I know, it's tough. I think probably the text that's on the flap and on the back is pretty close to what was in my initial query. Nobody really knew what to do, so. But I think it was, the writing that ended up selling it rather than the description. The agent who eventually signed me, I did that route and was querying agents before going directly to publishers and was signed by one. He said he just groaned when he saw the manuscript, which had been requested, the first reader had requested it. And, would not have started reading it if it wasn't his job, and then did, and said, ugh, it's going to fall apart, it's going to fall apart, it's going to fall apart. Halfway through, he's like, this has not fallen apart yet. I was hoping it did, but now I'm not anymore. So I don't. They're really hard to encapsulize without making it sound either kind of raunchy or cheesy. Or so if you ever figure it out, email me and let me know. Anyone else have questions or?
Mm-hmm. As a writer, do you feel that more of your challenges are external or internal?
Not entirely sure what that question means.
Are they things that you impose, like upon yourself, like giving yourself permission to take risks, or are they?
I think internal. At this stage, for me, certainly, because I've become in the last year fortunate enough to be able to write full time. But even when I was working a full-time day job and cramming writing in after hours, it's always, and struggling, and, you know, sending out the query letters. Yeah, I think the internal, finding the voice, taking the risk, is still the hardest. The external stuff can get tricky, too. But.
Mm-hmm. How many publishers did you send the manuscript off to before somebody bought it?
Well, because I got an agent first,
okay.
That's one of those things among aspiring writers, there's a lot of debate. Is it better to go the agent route? Because it's really hard to get an agent. The best way to get an agent is sell a book to a publisher. But if you do get one, what they can do is submit the manuscript simultaneously to multiple publishers, and it will actually get to an editor's desk rather than into the slush pile. I think that Dart went out to 12 publishers, and we had interest from maybe 7 or 8 of them. And ended up going with Tor, who made a preemptive offer and had been one of my top choices anyway, because they're extremely good in the field. I had, it kind of goes back to your previous question, I had held out a little bit of hope in some ways that it would find a mainstream publisher and then a broader audience, because science fiction and fantasy readers know the genre when they see it, no matter how it's packaged. But people who turn up their nose, and I just read something really funny about someone in Britain who was asked about a list of great British novels and said all of Terry Pratchett's should be struck. They were just horrible, although she hadn't actually read any, just one page, but science fiction just made her want to bang her head against a wall. What was her top pick? Orwell's 1984. But yeah, I sometimes think, well, if it had, you know, gotten a mainstream package, or people who are like, I don't read that stuff, would be a little more apt to take a chance on it. But then it might not find as broad a readership as it has, so. What's another one? The Sparrow. Mary Doria Russell wrote a novel called The Sparrow, and it was published as mainstream, and I think her publisher told her, don't ever mention the word science fiction. And she would do lectures and go, it's Jesuits in space. What do you want? Because there is such an unfortunate prejudice. Do you have any other questions? Or I'm happy to sign books for people who've brought them. I saw one or two floating around. I have not been approached, so I don't know. Did you say a friend who was a sales rep for Walden Books?
The buyer, the fantasy buyer.
Okay. Because I did a dinner kind of thing when they had their district buyers sale conference. And, oh gosh, I can't remember his name, but there was somebody there who asked me if I was interested in that possibility. Because we were talking about graphic novels. And I said, yeah, I certainly would be. I don't know anything about the format. I mean, from the creative end. But so it could be. As he said, well, maybe I'll talk to some people. So, but nothing that's gotten back to me. So I think it would be cool.
If it did come back to you, do you have any ideas for artists?
No, I'm not familiar enough with the field. I try to read in it, but I kind of get squirrely about spending the money, too, because they go so fast. So I'm sort of limited to what I can get from the library. So it's something I'd have to look into. But it would be interesting. No other burning questions? I think we're right about 8:30. Timed out well.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you very much for coming.